Hello, everyone, and welcome back to a very special episode of In Summation, The Final Word. As you all know, this is a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. We look at cases through the lens of the facts and arguments advanced by parties and the rulings made by the judges involved. We don't engage in strict red team, blue team, partisan hackery. There are thousands of podcasts out there dedicated to telling you exactly what you want to hear about your desired political affiliation. This just isn't one of them. And from the comments I get from listeners, I think you seem to prefer it that way. Today, I think we're going to be pushing that to its limit. Today's topic is very difficult to cover without treading into the realm of the culture war, but I think we can thread the needle if we're careful. Before jumping into the meat of today's topic, though, I do want to send a very special thank you to Eric Williams and his students at Radford University, who recently had me on as a guest to speak to his class about the Miranda case. It was a really great experience for me. The student comments were insightful. The questions were excellent. And so I want to say thank you, and hopefully we'll be able to do it again at some point. I really appreciate the opportunity and the invite. Okay, on to today. In this episode, we're going to once again deviate from the standard structure of how we typically approach cases. Usually, as you all know, we look at a few different legal issues through the lens of one particularly interesting criminal case. We dissect how each side argued their stance on the issues, we look at what the law is or was as it related to those issues, and we evaluate the rulings to see if they're in line with what we understand or understood the law to be. But thus far, with the exception of the episode where we looked at the Kyle Rittenhouse Wisconsin trial and the McMichael family Georgia trial, we look at one particular case. To address today's widely requested topic, I don't really want to do that, because I think to fairly cover this topic in an impartial light, we really have to look at how it's come up historically. Looking at just a single instance will come across as inherently biased. And that's because today we're going to discuss impeachment. Impeachment is the process by which one branch of government, Congress, drafts a formal accusation and holds a trial for the purpose of removing an individual from a duly elected office. We're going to focus today on presidential impeachment. So what we're going to do is drill down on what exactly that process entails, what the standards are for what needs to be proven, and whether there are any mechanisms in place to ensure that this doesn't become just a partisan witch hunt. Now, a lot of people have requested this. Most of you, I think, are genuinely curious about the process, wondering why the idea of impeachment seems to be constantly at the forefront of American political culture these days, and questioning whether it's always been that way. A few people, I think, have offered the topic because they want to support impeaching one side versus the other, or they want me to support impeachment efforts against certain individuals while decrying them against others. And I think for most of you, it's going to come as no surprise that I'm not going to do that. There have been three presidents who have been impeached and four total impeachment trials. So this is principally the impeachment trials of Andrew Johnson, Bill Clinton, and Donald Trump. Before we dive directly into the nitty-gritty details of the impeachment process, let's go through a bit of the history of impeachment so you have some contextual background to this particular episode. The power to impeach a president, sitting or otherwise, is derived from the Constitution, specifically in Article 1, Sections 2 and 3. Section 2 gives the House of Representatives the sole authority to draft articles of impeachment, and Article 3 gives the Senate the sole power to hold the impeachment trial. Listeners of this show can think of this as how a criminal defendant has to be charged with a formal charging document, whether that's a complaint or an indictment. And then a trial is held and a jury determines whether the prosecutor has proven the elements of the charges in that complaint or indictment beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, impeachment works in a similar fashion. You have to have the specific accusations, and then a trial is held on those accusations to see if the Senate believes that they have been proven. Now, I listed the three presidents who have been impeached. That does not mean that those are the only three presidents who have been involved in an impeachment proceeding. Those three presidents each had articles of impeachment drafted against him, and those articles were transmitted to the Senate for trial, and then a trial took place. In this country, we have never had a sitting president removed following an impeachment trial. But many other attempts at impeachment have been made. These attempts have been unsuccessful for a variety of reasons. Richard Nixon was impeached following the Watergate scandal. He chose to resign prior to the process running its course. Nixon left office on August 9th, 1974, and the articles of impeachment which had been drafted against him were not voted on by the House until August 20th, 1974, so 11 days after he left office. At this point, the issue was deemed moot, and no trial took place in the Senate. There have been two instances where a formal investigation took place in the House of Representatives and a vote was taken, but the articles of impeachment were not subsequently transmitted to the Senate because the vote failed. James Buchanan in 1860 and Andrew Johnson in 1867 both had impeachment attempted, but not enough House members voted to continue. Johnson, however, would go on to become impeached and go to trial the following year in 1868. In addition, a number of presidents had impeachment called for, but not enough traction to get a full House vote. And those presidents would be Thomas Jefferson, John Tyler, Ulysses Grant, Grover Cleveland, Herbert Hoover, Harry Truman, Lyndon Johnson, Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Joseph Biden. Now, astute listeners will note that the list of presidents from 1980 onward goes as follows. Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Donald Trump, Joseph Biden. So of the last seven presidents in our country's history, every single one of them has had some sort of articles of impeachment attempted against them. Understandably, some of these had more force behind them than others. For example, the attempt to impeach Joe Biden was initiated by Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene the day after Biden's inauguration, concerning an abuse of power relating to his dealings with Ukraine while his son Hunter was on the board of Ukrainian energy company Burisma. These articles went absolutely nowhere. George H.W. Bush had articles of impeachment introduced against him over the United States' involvement in the Gulf War by House Representative Henry Gonzalez. This, like Ms. Taylor Greene's filing, went absolutely nowhere. So just because a House representative initiates a filing seeking impeachment does not in any way convey any sort of general consensus or popular following for that effort. But it is indicative of a growing problem in American politics that both sides seem to acknowledge, albeit only for the other side. From 1789, when the Constitution was ratified, until 1998, 209 years, there was one impeachment trial for Andrew Johnson. One single trial held by the Senate. Johnson was openly disdainful of Congress and often had very public disagreements with both houses. Congress passed the Tenure of Office Act in an attempt to curb his power. Johnson vetoed the bill, Congress overrode the veto, and Johnson acted in flagrant violation of the newly passed law anyway, leading to his impeachment. After the Senate trial, Johnson was acquitted by a single vote, and thus not removed from office. This was in 1868. Another impeachment trial was not held until Bill Clinton in 1998, a full 130 years later. But more importantly, it wasn't viewed as a viable tool in the way that it has become over the last few decades. Seven presidents had some sort of attempted impeachment between 1789 and 1980. And seven presidents have had some sort of impeachment attempt between 1980 and 2022. That's a disturbing statistic to me. There is no question that impeachment has become a political attack as opposed to a legitimate concern over actions taken by the chief executive. That's not to say that all political motivations are exclusively a recent phenomenon. The impeachment attempt at Herbert Hoover was over economic issues. One particular Republican in Hoover's own party was upset at how Herbert Hoover was dealing with the Depression and filed impeachment papers, which were basically dead on arrival. Similarly, Democrat Milford Howard filed articles of impeachment against Grover Cleveland over his actions to break up the Pullman strike, which were purely politically motivated. So this idea of I'm on one team and the president is on the other team, and so I'm going to introduce articles of impeachment because the president is wearing a blue tie, or because he said something critical of some policy, or because he supports big government, or because he supports small government, or wants to raise taxes or lower taxes, this has all happened before. But it's certainly increasing at an alarming rate, and it seems that going forward, every president can expect at this point to have a member of the opposition party file articles of impeachment for something, even if it gets immediately tabled and is never sent to the committee or voted on. Okay, with that in mind, let's look at the process. Who brings the articles? How do they progress through the House? How are they transmitted to the Senate? What does a trial look like? And what's required to actively remove a sitting president? First things first, what does a president have to do in order to warrant impeachment? The Constitution, in Article 2, Section 4, says that the president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. High crimes has been held to be the equivalent of a felony in this day and age, and treason and bribery are both felonies, so it's a bit redundant, but it makes sense that those specific felonies would be named as they're particularly odious offenses for a public servant. But there's actually quite a bit of debate on this topic, especially in light of the most recent few presidents. The Constitution itself does not explicitly define high crimes and misdemeanors. We typically equate that with what we use in common day parlance as the definitional language. But the phrase high crimes and misdemeanors actually dates back to the 14th century. And in Britain at that time, where the concept of impeachment was first drawn up, the phrase didn't necessarily entail only criminal conduct. A review of the House Judiciary Committee during the impeachment attempt of Richard Nixon seems to follow this particular line of argument. The committee asserted that impeachment could be instituted where the president's actions caused damage to the state, which would not necessarily have to be criminal in nature. Presidential impeachments have not uniformly been accusations of criminal activity. Rather, they're based on the chief executive either doing or not doing something which the drafter of the articles disagrees with. The claims are usually that the president abused his, and someday her, power by ignoring some act of Congress or acting in a way that we may find generally distasteful. Here's a quick breakdown of the two schools of thought on what constitutes an impeachable offense. First, high crimes and misdemeanors means only criminal actions. The United States Code contains a specific list of high crimes and misdemeanors. If something is not on that list attached with a potential criminal penalty, it is not a federal crime, much as some of us might want it to be. But in this country, in the United States, we don't look at some action taken after the fact, think to ourselves, well, that should be a crime, and then punish somebody criminally for doing it. That's called a due process violation, because every individual has a due process right to know what is and what is not against the law. If something is not against the law at the time an individual does it, then they cannot be criminally punished for it. With that in mind, abuse of power is not a federal crime. There is no legal statutory prohibition for abuse of power and no related potential penalty in the United States Code for abusing power. As such, a president cannot be rightly impeached for the nebulous claim of abuse of power or any actions which aren't specifically defined crimes. Now, if the abusive action is also a crime in and of itself, then the president can be impeached for the substantive crime, but not simply for the term abuse of power. Now, the second school of thought on this is the historical damage to the state paradigm. Here, the measure of whether conduct is impeachable does not depend on whether there's a specific statutory code which prohibits it, but rather whether the result of the conduct is a significant harm to the country or the office of the president. If the conduct causes harm to the people or to the office, then the conduct is impeachable. Under this theory, flouting the laws of Congress, abusing power, exerting undue pressure on foreign leaders, cronyism, etc., are all potentially impeachable offenses given the nature of the outcome of those actions. We saw the debate between these dueling approaches to impeachment come to a head during the first impeachment of Donald Trump, where Article 1 of the impeachment was abuse of power. Trump's allies protested that abuse of power was not a federal crime, and therefore it couldn't constitute an article of impeachment, while others seeking Trump's removal from office pointed to the second approach, saying his phone call with Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky was an abuse of power, which damaged the office of the presidency, and therefore was impeachable. Just my opinion now, but I think that Congress will choose whichever approach is favored by the majority of people in Congress designed to achieve the outcome they are looking for. I do not think we are going to see one side of this win out over the other and become the generally accepted view of impeachable actions. When Congress wants to protect their president, they will say that whatever the offensive action wasn't a crime. When Congress wants to go after the president, abuse of power looks a whole lot more menacing. In 1970, Gerald Ford, House Minority Leader at the time, said that an impeachable offense is whatever a majority of the House of Representatives considers it to be at any given moment in history. And I really think he's onto something there. There has, however, been some effort to offer guidance on this topic. In 1974, in the wake of the Watergate scandal, the House Judiciary Committee prepared a report called the Constitutional Grounds for Presidential Impeachment, which sought to clarify the term high crimes and misdemeanors and the relationship to actual criminal conduct. This document is used as a guide. It is not binding, and it does seem to be ignored when the majority in power disinterested with its actual report language, but it is there, and it does provide some support for the idea that abuse of power is an impeachable offense. Now let's talk process. This is where I think a lot of people get tripped up when they want to hold themselves out to be authorities on impeachment. We previously discussed that impeachment starts in the House of Representatives and that the trials take place in the Senate. There's a three-step process which is generally followed. First, Congress launches an investigation, usually through the House Judiciary Committee, though there's no rule that it must begin there. This investigation is not formulaic. How Congress chooses to fact-find is the subject of wide discretion. Congress has the ability to bring people in and take sworn testimony from them. They have the power to impanel commissions dedicated to uncovering the truth about some particular topic. Think of the January 6th Commission, or Benghazi, or the Tower Commission for the Iran-Contra affair. Congress can subpoena documents and materials and force people to turn over records. An investigation is almost always the first step, but it's actually not technically necessary. The second impeachment of Donald Trump went straight to step two. It did not wait for an investigative body to draft a report of its findings. In fact, on November 24th, 2022, the date I am recording this, the January 6th committee is still ongoing. Likewise, the attempts by Marjorie Taylor Greene to introduce articles of impeachment against Joe Biden did not come out of any sort of inquisitorial group. She drafted them herself and just submitted them. So that brings us to step two, the drafting of articles of impeachment. The articles are like formal charges, like a criminal complaint, which accuse the president of the conduct which the drafter believes is cause for his or her removal from power. The articles will have as many counts as pass. There's no minimum, there is no maximum. Once the articles are drafted, the House has to decide what to do with them. The rules of procedures are codified in a document called Jefferson's Manual. Any House member can submit articles of impeachment. Again, it does not need to come by way of the Judiciary Committee, and it does not need to be drafted by any particular member of the Judiciary Committee. There are 435 members of the House of Representatives, so there are 435 potential accusers of the president. Once the articles are drafted, they are given to the House Judiciary Committee to determine what to do with them. The committee has options. They can either hold a committee vote to determine whether to send the articles to the House at large, they can table the articles and elect not to do anything with them, or they can seek further information before holding a vote. The third option, to seek additional information, usually only comes into play when the investigation originates from somewhere other than the House Judiciary Committee itself. If an independent special counsel, like, say, for example, somebody named Ken Starr, is the source of the information leading to articles of impeachment, the House Judiciary Committee may elect to engage in their own fact-finding before coming to a vote. If the committee decides to bury the articles, that's basically the end. They will never go to vote. They are just forgotten. That tends to happen when very partisan representatives draft articles on their own. Lest we labor under the impression that raising dead-on-arrival articles of impeachment is a one-sided partisan thing, let's look at some of the recent attempts that went nowhere. As we've noted, Marjorie Taylor Greene filed specious articles of impeachment the day after Joseph Biden's inauguration. On the flip side, Henry Gonzalez, Democratic representative from Texas, filed articles of impeachment against Ronald Reagan in 1983, and then two separate articles of impeachment against George H.W. Bush, both in 1991. None of these had any merit and died in the House Judiciary Committee. They were done as theater to demonstrate opposition to certain policies and actions supported by those two presidents. If the House Judiciary Committee votes not to proceed, then the matter is closed. But if they vote to turn the matter over to the full House, then all 435 members of the House are eligible to vote. All that is required is a majority of those present to vote yes for impeachment. All 435 members do not need to be present. Anyone not present is simply excluded from the vote. So if all 435 members are there, then 218 yes votes are needed to carry the impeachment. If only 399 representatives are present in session for whatever reason, then only 200 yes votes are required. So it's just whatever is needed to get over that 50% threshold for the members in the room at the time. In criminal cases, as we know, the burden of proof that the prosecutor has to meet is guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And while there is no set definition of that phrase, most courts have a somewhat similar set of instructions on exactly what that means. Naturally, impeachment is not a criminal proceeding. At the end of it, the president or other government official being impeached is not facing prison time. They may be later on for the same actions, but this particular process does not have prison implications. Accordingly, the standard is not that the representative must be convinced that the president committed the acts set forth in the articles of impeachment beyond a reasonable doubt. So what then is the appropriate standard? What's the level of proof that has to be met as a baseline before a House representative is supposed to vote in favor of articles of impeachment? There are two answers to this question. There's the optimist answer, and there's the realist answer. The optimist answer goes something like this. Each representative is responsible for voting their conscience. If that individual is moved after careful consideration of the arguments presented, that he or she is duty-bound by the oath of office taken, that regardless of party affiliation or partisanship, he or she will affirm the articles for the good of the nation to preserve the sanctity of the office of the president. Unfortunately, Congress is made up of humans, and humans don't generally act that way. The realist answer is that representatives largely vote along party lines. There have been occasions where representatives have bucked their backers and voted to impeach. For example, when Bill Clinton was impeached, on three of the four counts, there were five Democrats who voted yes on impeachment, and anywhere from 5 to 28 Republicans who voted no. Even in the impeachment trials of Donald Trump, you see party lines being the defining consideration. In the first impeachment, not a single Republican voted yes on either of the two articles, and only two Democrats voted no on Articles 1 and 3 Democrats voted no on Article 2. Even going back to 1868, when Andrew Johnson was impeached, the vote was 125 Republicans voting yes, as opposed to zero Democrats, and 44 Democrats voting no, while not a single Republican sided with them. Remember, this was about Johnson violating a law that had so much support that it overturned a presidential veto. Even in that scenario, the vote still went down party lines instead of backing Congress as an institution. The Watergate scandal, cover-up, and resulting investigation into Richard Nixon is rightly considered one of the most significant instances of presidential misconduct in history. And even then, when voting in the House Judicial Committee, a majority of Republicans voted against every single article of impeachment relating to Nixon. On the charge of abuse, which had the most Republican support, the breakdown was only still 7 yes votes and 10 no's. Rank partisanship and gamesmanship has always been a part of impeachment, regardless of who's in power. But if the House of Representatives is able to amass a majority of votes, the president is considered impeached. There's a common misconception that impeached means convicted at the Senate trial. That's not what it means. Impeached just means that the House voted to authorize the Senate to conduct the trial. Johnson, Clinton, and Trump have all been impeached, and that a majority of the present members of the House voted to move the process forward, but none of them were convicted and removed by the Senate. Once the president is impeached, the House of Representatives transfers the articles of impeachment to the Senate, where the trial is held. Here's where the really interesting part of the process takes place, at least in my opinion. Now, the Senate conducts the trial on the articles, and only on the articles. It doesn't matter if all 100 senators think that the president committed some atrocity not contained in the articles themselves. They have no power or authority to add extra charges. They can't even shoehorn additional actions into vague accusations like abuse of power or obstruction of justice, because those charges must carry specifics in the articles as to what exactly the House is claiming the president did to commit those actions. In a criminal trial, you need a unanimous jury to convict. In a Senate impeachment, you need 2/3 of the members. So 67 senators have to vote to convict and remove the president. That is an extremely high threshold and the reason that it's never happened. Partisanship has never been overcome to the point that sufficient people will jump the aisle and agree that the president's actions were so egregious that I don't care if he's our guy or our woman, they've got to go. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court acts as the judge. For Donald Trump, that was Justice John Roberts both times. For Bill Clinton, it was Justice William Rehnquist. For Andrew Johnson, it was Chief Justice Salmon P. Chase. Yes, we once had a Chief Justice of the Supreme Court who shared his name with a fish. As with a criminal trial judge, the Chief Justice's role in the impeachment trial is to ensure that the appropriate rules and procedures are being followed, not to rule on the facts of what happened. A select group of the House of Representative members act as the prosecution team. They introduce evidence, they call witnesses, and are responsible for making the arguments in favor of impeachment at the close of the trial. The president is traditionally represented by White House counsel. The office of the president has its own staff lawyer, but the president is free to supplement with additional private lawyers, and both Clinton and Trump did so. Let's talk about the introduction of testimony and evidence. The House representatives serving as prosecutors call witnesses and ask them questions, very similar to how a criminal trial would go. They will also introduce documents or recordings or other tangible physical items as evidence. When I spoke to a few friends and told them I was doing an episode on the mechanics of impeachment, they all wanted to know whether hearsay was allowed in an impeachment trial. This is a great question. In federal criminal trials, there's a book, The Federal Rules of Evidence, which governs what types of evidence are admissible and for what purposes. For the most part, the rules are set. The players all know them, or at least they should. As a general matter, there is no law or written rule that the federal rules of evidence apply to impeachment trials. They have generally been adopted, but if push came to shove, there would be no argument that the impeachment trial was required under the rules of the process to follow the federal rules of evidence to the letter. That being said, the adoption of the rules does allow for a level playing field and equal application, so it really is the right thing to do. Now, utilizing the rules also brings the prohibition against hearsay into the proceeding. My own personal opinion time, hearsay has no place in any serious formal legal proceeding, whether that be a federal criminal trial, whether that be a state criminal trial, whether that be an impeachment proceeding. For those who don't work in the tawdry industry of law, hearsay is an out-of-court statement being offered in court for the truth of the matter asserted. In plain English, it means someone is in court testifying about what someone else said for the purpose of establishing the truth of the statement itself. For example, if Eric is on the stand, he can be asked the question, "Did you have a conversation with Justin?" That question is fine because Eric is simply testifying to the fact that a conversation took place. It's based on his own personal experience in taking part in that conversation. But if Eric is on the stand and asked the question, "What did Justin say to you during your conversation?" On its face, that would be hearsay. Now, there are a number of exceptions in the federal rules of evidence which provide for the introduction of certain hearsay statements for reasons other than the prohibited desire to establish that the statement is true in and of itself. We are not going to go into all of those here. That's like 2 weeks worth of evidence class in law school. For our purposes, suffice it to say that in practice, the impeachment trial will follow the federal rules of evidence and prohibit hearsay when it does not have a legitimate purpose. During the trial itself, senators are permitted to ask questions. Unlike standard jury deliberations, the Senate vote is public, so anyone following the impeachment trial will know how any particular senator voted. There is no privacy, no Australian ballot, no secret writing down, yays or nays. Everybody's vote is known. At the conclusion, if 67 senators vote to remove the president, then the president is indeed removed from office. The Senate trial can also result in the president being prohibited from holding public office in the future. This result has also never happened to a president. In reality, though, of all federal officials who have been impeached since 1789, just over half of them have ended up being removed from public office. So while presidents have enjoyed a perfect track record of winning in the Senate, many other posts have not fared quite so well. If the vote to convict is short of the 67 needed, then the attempt to remove fails, and the president basically just goes back to work. There is no appeal process on either side. So that's the process side of this. You now know exactly what happens during a full impeachment process. We as a country are living in an impeachment age. It certainly just seems to be something that presidents are going to have to live with these days. Some accusations are more serious and are more backed up by evidence than others, but we are at a point in American history where you can pretty much guarantee that if the president is from party one, then some House member from party two is going to introduce articles of impeachment at some point. That's obviously not to say that grounds for impeachment haven't existed, but my view on this whole process is that the prevailing feeling when a House member or Senate member of the same political party as the president is considering impeachment, they're just thinking to themselves, well, maybe this guy is a crook, but at least he's our crook and he does the things we want. So at the end of the day, I don't care that he's a crook and I'm going to blame everything on the other party. In summation, impeachment in the modern era is more about political climate than about legitimate, serious concerns about wrongdoing. That doesn't mean that there hasn't been legitimacy to any recent impeachment attempts. But overall, the fact that every president since 1980 has had House members attempt impeachment is a good indicator that this is no longer the somber last resort against a president who refuses to follow the law. My personal view is that the concept of impeachment was instituted to act as a check on abuses of power. I do not personally think a president should be formally accused of a crime in order to trigger a legitimate impeachment proceeding. I think there are plenty of things a sitting president could do to abuse power in office, which would still leave me feeling like removal is appropriate. But at the same time, I have a serious problem with the trend of thinking that policy choices that a congressman or congresswoman may disagree with constitute an abuse of power. The Constitution grants the president the title of commander-in-chief over the army, so military decisions are largely executive branch functions. Just because I disagree with a decision to perpetuate an endless war, or I believe that we invaded some country to maintain the cheap flow of oil, does not mean that that decision is necessarily impeachable. We're running towards a boy who cried wolf scenario. We catastrophize every single decision by political opponents to the extent that truly egregious actions now just kind of melt into the zeitgeist of constant Armageddon-dom. Andrew Johnson was impeached for explicitly and flagrantly ignoring a law because he simply didn't want to follow it. The precedent which that would set was clear. If Johnson was able to disregard congressional authority on a whim, then all future presidents would be invited to do the same. Even though he wasn't removed from office over it, the message was sent that a president is not above the law. Bill Clinton was impeached for perjury in a grand jury proceeding and obstruction of justice as it related to the Monica Lewinsky affair and accusations that he influenced witness testimony in a federal civil rights action brought against him. I myself remember the impeachment trial of Bill Clinton. I remember the media playing his quote over and over again, "I did not have sex with that woman." Ultimately, it seems that Clinton did lie to a grand jury, and it appears that he did attempt to influence his civil rights case by offering false affidavits by witnesses. But was impeachment the right route as a result of this? Hardline Republicans certainly thought so. You heard a lot in the late 90s about the president not being above the law, and about how the office of the president was smeared by his actions, and how honesty from the president is some long-treasured stable commodity which all of a sudden was ripped away from the American people when Bill Clinton lied to us about having sex with Monica Lewinsky. On the other hand, did any of this action impair Clinton's ability to run the country? Was it so corrupt that he could no longer execute the office of the president? Had faith in that institution become so eroded because of this that reluctant members of the House had no choice but to pursue impeachment for the sake of the American people? Just my opinion here, but I think not. I think this was a chance for Republicans to take a shot at a relatively popular Democrat president. And ultimately, it ended up backfiring tremendously, as lots of impeachment attempts do. I personally think the vast majority of the American people want to get along with each other. We lose sight of that sometimes because the most vocal groups seem to be on the fringes, but I think deep down, most of us don't think in terms of how to maximize political points and equate the right action with whatever brings shame and dishonor to my political enemies. Most of us don't share that hatred which both sides seem to want to foment so badly. And at the end of the day, when these processes drag on, which they always tend to do, people get fatigued from it. It becomes a farce. The real zealots come off looking petty. Donald Trump was impeached twice, a record he alone holds. On two occasions, he was tried before the Senate, and on two occasions, he was acquitted by the Senate. No one divides like Donald Trump does. Some people love him, think he is the answer to everything wrong with the swamp or politics as usual. Others hate everything he stands for and cannot understand why he hasn't been arrested. They are convinced with metaphysical certainty that Donald Trump is a criminal on levels rarely ever seen before, and that every day he breathes free air is an affront to truth and justice. I am at neither extreme, personally. I don't care for him. I won't vote for him in 2024 if he does win the Republican nomination, but I do not feel the need to crusade for his incarceration. I think his words and actions have made it clear he's a bad guy, but if being a bad person was a disqualifier for American politics, the chambers of Congress would be pretty empty. Trump's first impeachment was for asking Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who is now a household name for defending Ukraine from Russian invasion, to investigate Hunter Biden's involvement in Ukrainian energy company Burisma, where he sat on the board and earned a pretty significant salary despite having no experience or knowledge about the energy industry. Trump has made plenty of public statements indicating that he felt that Burisma was using Hunter Biden to curry favor with the then Vice President, Joseph Biden, who had an important voice in Ukraine policy at the time. The allegations in the articles of impeachment were that Trump abused his power by pressuring the president of Ukraine to investigate a political rival and setting up a quid pro quo of only providing aid to the country if Zelensky did what Trump wanted. The second impeachment concerned the January 6th riot, where attendees at a Trump rally broke off, stormed the Capitol building, disrupted the certification of Joseph Biden as the president. Rioters caused members of Congress to be evacuated for their safety. They caused property damage. Some of them stole items from offices. Many were arrested and are being prosecuted. The impeachment claimed that Trump had incited the insurrection. It should be noted that the second impeachment articles were drafted in mid-January 2021. Trump left office on January 21st, 2021, meaning the House vote took place before he left office. But by the time the trial took place in the Senate that February, Trump was already out of office. Every statement that Trump made during his speech on January 6th has been dissected. His actions during the day have been replayed. What's been most interesting to me about the two impeachment proceedings that relate to Trump is the different way that Trump's actions in both sequences are viewed depending on your political leanings. The anti-impeachment camp on the first proceeding says Zelensky never investigated Joe or Hunter Biden, and Ukraine still got the aid they were promised. So what exactly is the big deal? Where's the problem? Did Trump's actions have any negative effect on the office of the presidency? No. This is pure political theater and is being done to rile up the Democratic base, and that's it. On the other hand, the pro-impeachment group is aghast, simply astonished that anyone in this country could ever think that conditioning aid for personal or political favors from the office of the president could ever happen. The very idea of it is so unconscionable that anyone who did such a thing would be unfit for office. I think these lines stayed fairly consistent with the impeachment over the January 6th riot. While most people I interact with on both sides of the political spectrum agree that the events of January 6th were horrific, there is significant disagreement as to whether or not Donald Trump incited an insurrection. The first group believes that Trump's rally set those people into a bit of a frenzy, but having examined what Trump actually said, there was no real call to immediate lawless action. His rhetoric may have been aggressive, but at no point did he actually say anything which indicated he wanted people to break into the Capitol building and commit wanted acts of destruction. This group sees this act not as a coordinated, organized, and planned attack, but rather as a mob that stopped thinking rationally and let their passions take control. Our second group believes the entirety of the blame is squarely on Trump. They believe that this was Trump's plan from the beginning, that he orchestrated January 6th in a last-ditch effort to effect a coup and declare himself president for life. They think this was a coordinated effort and that people who went there knew the code words for the instructions Trump was giving them. There is no question, then, that this was a clear incitement to insurrection. Both attempts to remove Trump from office or prohibit him from holding public office again have failed. And again, both broke down roughly along party lines. Here's the basic reason that impeachment will never work. To remove the president, you need 67 senators to vote yes. Even in 2008, when the Democrats had a super majority, they controlled 60 votes. Convincing 7, much less 17, senators from the president's party to break ranks and join in the effort is probably never going to happen. These people are more concerned with facing primary challengers and getting reelected than they care about the honesty and integrity of the office of the president. And that's wrong. Members of Congress should care. I think we all wish our members of Congress would put aside their partisan divisions and vote their conscience when it comes to this. But our system has set itself up so that the risks inherent in doing that are so grave that it just doesn't make sense for anyone to actually see it through. Long gone are the days where we sent true statesmen and stateswomen to the Capitol to represent the best interests of all of their constituents to the absolute best of their ability. So members of Congress will continue to make hopelessly futile attempts to remove sitting presidents because it shows the most rabid among their base that the representatives hate the other party as much as they do, and it will help with fundraising and it will help with campaigning, but it's fundamentally unserious. Johnson, Clinton, and Trump have shown themselves to be the exceptions rather than the rule. The few times where the party in power had enough political clout in the House to push through an impeachment effort. I'm certainly not saying that if a president commits acts of grave official malfeasance that Congress should do nothing about it because chances are that removal isn't going to happen. Far from it, they should take action. But I do think the American people would be far more amenable to the idea of a real impeachment trial if everyone would stop making it a rite of passage into the presidency. So that's basically everything you need to know about how impeachment works, or rather, why it doesn't. Thank you to my brother, Dan Townsend, for editing today's program. Thank you, listeners, for your support of In Summation. I really do appreciate the thoughtful messages I get and the discussions that they generate. Thank you so much for the recommendations, like impeachment. If you want to get in touch with me to suggest a topic, to suggest a case, if you want to ask me a question about criminal law or just want to send me a message unrelated to the show, please email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com, or you can tweet me at insummationpod. I'm on Instagram at Insummation. You can visit the show's website, insummation.com, or check out the show's Facebook page, or you can look me up on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. While I'm pretty awful with updating social media, I do try to be very good about responding to listeners who write in with questions and comments, so please do so. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show, and if you rate and review it, it will help other people find it as well. If you're new, please feel free to check out the entire catalog. I'm hoping to do another few guest episodes soon, and I have a few who've agreed to come on and discuss some really great cases. I just need to work out some scheduling, so I hope you can have that to look forward to. As always, thanks for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.